Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AdJam podcast. I'm your host, Belle Cheeves, and I'm here with Dr. Bita Baghulizadeh, historian and associate research scholar at Princeton's Mosavar Rahmani Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies. We'll be discussing her first book, The Color Black, Enslavement and Erasure in Iran, which just came out in March and is already award-winning. Congratulations on this phenomenal book, Bita.
Thank you so much, Val. Thank you.
It is really such an honor to be doing this interview with you because, well, you were one of the people who brought me into AdJam to begin with, so it feels very full circle. And your work is one of the main inspirations for my own research and has really shaped my thinking in so many ways. And I remember workshopping, I think it was a chapter of your dissertation a few years ago, and just to see what you've done transforming your work into this groundbreaking masterpiece is wonderful to witness. And I'm very excited to be having this conversation with you today.
Thanks, Belle. It means a lot to me that we're having this interview, that you know, it's on AdJam, that I'm back in AdJam, but in the interviewee seat, not the interviewer seat anymore. So yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. So The Color Black is not just a brilliant history. This is a call for remembering those who were enslaved in Iran and written out of that history of enslavement following abolition, and how those erasures, particularly surrounding blackness and enslaved black people, occurred in Iran. It is a book that really any historian interested in archival practices and erasures should read. It is a book that should also be on sociology and anthropology syllabi, and anyone studying race, enslavement, abolition, or empire should really be reading this book, even though studying histories of photography and art and architecture should be. There's just so much here I want to talk about, but before we dive in, can you briefly set the stage for our listeners? What did enslavement in Iran actually look like?
Thanks, Belle. It's a big question to start
yes.
with. You know, enslavement in Iran over the course of various centuries, it looked different. By the 19th century, and my book really looks at the 19th and 20th centuries, by the 19th century, even though historically there were different groups of people who were vulnerable to enslavement within Iran, basically anyone around their borders. So the Caucasus, Central Asia, South Asia, and East Africa. There are a bunch of different geopolitical changes that happened. Russia grew more powerful in the north. Great Britain grew more powerful in South Asia. So there are these different groups that were vulnerable to enslavement historically, but by the 19th century, really the East Africans were the last to remain the most vulnerable, I would say. And so you have this period of intense racialization where even though colors had been used as adjectives to describe people,
right.
The white eunuchs, the black slaves, the black eunuchs, the white slaves. And these terms were very much malleable. They would have referred to, you know, Caucasians or Central Asians or South Asians or East Africans. In the 19th century, only one of those terms, only black, becomes a noun. You no longer have to qualify the adjective. You can just use the color as a noun. And it really only referred to East Africans and no longer South Asians as it had done historically. And when it was used, it really did imply an enslaved status.
Right.
So what kinds of work were people doing as they were enslaved? This also varied by region. In the South, you had examples of chattel slavery. You had date plantations and pearl diving. My book really does not focus on that as much. I'm much more interested in forms of enslavement in the urban centers. And in those urban centers, the type of labor that was really expected of the enslaved were domestic incapacity. So the type of work that really is quite critical to everyday living. So childcare, cooking, cleaning, the kind of stuff that people take for granted, but really nothing would work without it, right?
Exactly.
So that's what I'm looking at. living spaces, how people are moving in and out of those spaces, what is expected of them, how they're viewed.
So you divide the book into two parts. Part one is about enslavement, and part two is about erasure, much like your title hints. In part one, you trace the forced visibility of enslaved Black people in Iran. And then in part two, you trace the forced invisibility of those freed Black people in particular, as well as the erasure of the history of enslavement in Iran itself from collective memory. This frame of forced visibility and then forced invisibility is so important. And I'm curious to hear more about how you arrived at it and how you came to the project to begin with.
Wow, thank you for that question. That's like three big questions in one. So let me answer sort of backwards. So how did I arrive at this frame?
Yes.
So as you know, and people who are familiar with my name now, I'm an Iranian American. I was born and raised in LA, but very much steeped in the Iranian community and diaspora. And really something that was sort of drilled in me is that Iranians are not racist. They don't see race. And then when I started even working on my project, well, Iranians don't have slavery. There was never any history of slavery. This was a very strong denial that I heard from a lot of people, ranging from other academics to archivists, to just people who would stop me and ask me what I was working on and then decide to give their two cents. And so the project really had started as a 19th century history project, right? I really liked that period. I was more interested in looking at how people moved, what does forced migration look like, and how do we honor those histories and how do we reflect on them and remember them properly. But as I worked more on my project, I got so many more voices telling me, well, it didn't exist, right? And so I really found that was stretching my project to address this collective amnesia that I was seeing across society, right? It's not just, it wasn't just the very, you know, high class, rich descendants of the Qajar family who were denying this history, who, you know, have their own complicated ways of dealing with their family histories. And I talk a little bit about that.
Right.
But it was also everyday people who had no stake in that history, right? That became really interesting to me.
Oh, extremely. Yeah.
And so I thought that I needed to address both the enslavement and the erasure. Mm-hmm. But also I found that I was writing towards both an academic audience and also a non-academic audience. And part of that is, you know, from working with Ajam for so long, where, you know, it's there's a lot of interest that comes in from non-academics as well.
And it's so important to write to a broad audience and have your work be accessible. That's one of the things I adore about this book. It is accessible. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. I really did try to make it accessible. But one thing that I really was dealing with was people telling me, well, no, Cyrus the Great, he freed all the slaves. And that's why on page two of the book, I literally have like, he did not free all the slaves. And even if he did, it would be irrelevant. You know, like something that happened 2,500 years ago does not dictate what something looks like in the 19th century.
Right.
And so the frame became really important for me from both a sort of scholarly standpoint as the author of this book, but also just as a tool to provide tools to people who are trying to study this history, who are getting all these voices and all this sort of outside noise, giving them tools for being like, no, you think it doesn't exist because XYZ things happened. Like 1929, abolition. Within two decades, the dictionaries are being rewritten, right? These histories are being rewritten. We now have the Cyrus cylinder, which is totally reinterpreted. And then we have the very, very heavy burden of a history of enslavement as a taint on an individual, on a family, and on a country.
Right.
And how people were managing that. And that's what these voices are doing. They're trying to manage this perceived taint, which I think instead of erasing it needs to be addressed so that we can move forward.
Absolutely.
So that's really how I came to frame the book and think of the book.
I love that. So continuing on this vein of the research process itself, you discuss throughout the book the importance of archival practices and especially of these archival erasures. You have a wonderful line in your last chapter that I'd like to read. One wonders how these histories might differ if the voices of the enslaved were readily available and not filtered through bureaucratic papers or the albums of their enslaving families. I'd love for you to talk more about this in general for our listeners, and I'm particularly interested to hear more about these albums of the enslaving families. You use photographs throughout the book and actually dedicate a couple chapters to discussions of photographs, those of enslaved Black people included in family portraits to showcase the family's wealth and privilege, amongst other things, and also those of eunuchs in Nasser ad-Din Shah's imperial household. Can you tell us more about these photographs, these archives, and some of the ways in which voices or images of the enslaved were filtered?
Absolutely. I was lucky enough to do research across a few different countries in the UK, in Switzerland, in Iran. And then I also used digital archives like the Women's Worlds and Ghadra Iran archive that you worked on at Harvard under Afsana Najmabadi. And I found a lot of sources, right?
Yes.
And there's this line in the introduction where I quote Xavier Wingham, who's a good colleague of the both of us. Where he says, I was told I wouldn't find anything, but I did find something.
I love that line.
I love that line, right? So because it captures so much. And it really does. It really does capture the sort of experience of doing this research where people were maybe skeptical of our work or discouraging of it even. And you go and you're in the archives and you do find stuff. And then you also realize why you were told you might not find things. It's partially because of, you know, these collective erasures that we've already talked about that people are like, it's not going to exist, right? But also the way things are categorized, this meandering process of going through files. A lot of files in Iran are now digitized, or at least the sort of catalogs are. But it's not something where I can just go in and type in the term for an enslaved person. The sort of catch-all term is barde. I can't just type that in for two reasons. A, that term is just not recognized as referring to this type of enslavement because of that sort of rewriting of the dictionaries that I talked about. Right. Barde is really it's really used to reference U.S. or North American forms of plantation slavery. But also in Persian, barde is written the same way as borde, right? The past verb tense for to have taken. And so I would get a lot of random, you know, things pop up. And I'm like, this is not what I was looking for.
Right.
And so it becomes this really slow, meandering process. In the Golestan photo archives, where I did a lot of research, a lot of the photographs of the enslaved are in these albums that are referred to as the women's albums.
Right.
Right. And this goes back to the domestic forms of labor, the spaces that these enslaved people occupied, the types of work that they were expected to do, but also reflects that they're just sort of an afterthought.
Right.
Right. It's the archives are not organized for them.
Right.
And so, like Xavier says in his really beautiful line, I did find something, but I found things in such odd places.
Right.
Right. I did find something, but I found them in such odd places. And that's because even the people who were donating these documents or photographs or whatever, even for them, the enslaved were an afterthought, right? Because so many of the sources came from enslaving families, or they came from sort of bureaucratic processes. You know, I talk about the British and their sources, and, you know, it's sort of looked down upon in Middle East studies or Middle East history to, you know, look at the British sources. It's like seen as a cop-out, right? You don't know the languages. But I really think it's important to take those seriously, because the way that the British archives are set up is like, look at all these sources we have on slavery, right? Like, you walk in, you will find something, because like there's tens and tens of boxes like slavery and anti-slavery. That's like their whole thing, right? Champions of abolition worldwide. But when you look through the sources, even the enslaved are the afterthought in those sources. So that became really important for me to think about and to hold true while I was writing, right?
Absolutely.
That these archives are not necessarily in conversation with the descendants of the enslaved. They might be in the future, but they really have not been thus far. And sort of thinking about that, photography just became such an important source for me because of a few different things. First, I argued that, and I argue this in my book, that the language of enslavement in Iran in the 19th century was as much a visual and spatial language as it was a written language, right? Or textually oriented language. So yes, there were words, there were racial slurs, but they can only get us so far. And it was really important for me to think about the spatial demarcations of a home or the city, and then the spatial demarcations of a photograph.
Absolutely.
Why do these photographs all look so similar, right? And that brings me to my second reason why I really take photography seriously, is the photographs of the enslaved do all really look very similar, or overwhelmingly similar. Of course, there are exceptions to this, but they really do. And it's because enslaved Black people were amongst the first people to be photographed in Iran.
Right.
The Shah, Nasiruddin Shah, was a very avid photographer, photograph hobbyist, whatever you want to call it. He loved building photography studios. So he's photographing members of the court.
Right.
But who can he, of course he's the Shah, he can boss anyone around, but who can he boss around more? Who can he subject to more photographs than anyone else? It's the enslaved.
Right.
And they are there in a lot of his photographs. And so very quickly on, the Shah and his photographers and the other members of the court are setting up this language of photography that holds in Iran for a few generations, right? It holds into the early 20th century. So that's, you know, several decades of this type of visuality. Right. And this brings me to that whole frame of the forced visibility that you asked about earlier.
Yeah.
And then how quickly, so quickly after abolition, there are really very few photographs, family, right? And in quotes,
family, yes.
The air quotes, the family photographs, which are really household photographs. After abolition, people are not taking these household portraits or family portraits with Black people in them, even if they had kept them around as servants or were in touch with the people who they had formerly enslaved. They're not in the photographs anymore, and this becomes such an important part, a key part of the forced invisibility of abolition.
Right. So on this note of the family in this sense as well, you write about this common trope of, slaves were just part of the family. They weren't really slaves. And how this was presented both at the time in some of these photographs where you have enslaved Black people included in these family, or rather, I think as you very importantly point out, household photographs, but also how this is still a trope more recently. Can you tell our listeners more about this and how this trope contributes to the erasures of enslavement?
It's funny. Sometimes people are very forthcoming with this trope. No. Those people were just part of the family.
Right.
Other times, there are people who will, like, literally fight me.
Oh, no.
Right?
I'm so sorry.
Who will be like, no. Iran never had slavery. Iran never had slavery. Iran never had slavery. And then I'm like, okay, but X, Y, Z.
Right.
And they'll say, no. Those were members of the family. I'm like, okay, so you admit that there were people brought into a family who have to be identified singularly as members of the family. No one ever has to say my daughter is a member of the family, right? Or my brother-in-law or anything like that. But when there's this emphasis on, they were members of the family, it sort of to me indicates something else that's going on, right?
Oh, absolutely.
What are they making up for? The way it operates in these photographs is the photographs become this sort of double-edged, I don't want to say sword, it's not really, it's like a double-edged narrative. It was used to highlight enslavement, right? And that's why the photographs really are mapped out in such a particular way. Like, right. Once you've seen several, you will be able to read the next, because it's a pattern, right? It's a pattern. You know who the enslavers are. They're clustered at the center. You know who the enslaved are. They're usually standing up to the side or behind them. And very rarely are they in the front, unless they're children who are enslaved, who wouldn't be visible from the back because they're simply too short. It's very clear to someone who's seen, more than one, more than a few of these photographs. But then after abolition, these same photographs became proof for enslaving families to say, oh, look, like, we even photographed them. Like, oh, obviously, God. We love them.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Which is very heavy, right?
Extremely. Yeah.
Because the people who were enslaved were not photographed out of love.
Right.
And in fact, if you look at the photographs closely, they look, in many cases, highly uncomfortable, very tense, not really interested to be in the photograph. And I can think of photographs of adults who were enslaved, mm-hmm. of an adult Black woman who looks very, very uncomfortable, of children who look very upset.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes you wonder what else they were forced to do.
Oh, absolutely.
But in the absence of this context, when people have really bought into this idea that enslavement doesn't exist, then this sort of alternate logic appears where, we've included them because we love them. We've included them because they're members of the family. Sort of basing their logic on the post-abolition logic that you would not include someone who was not a member of the family in a photograph. So why else would these people be there? Well, they were in the photograph because they were enslaved, and they were enslaved as a sign of prestige.
Right.
And they were enslaved to be seen, to represent the family inside the house, outside of the house, with the family present, without the family present. What better way than a photograph that is permanent,
right?
That the family can hold on to, the family can pass down, the family can see, look how prestigious our family was, look at the status we had, we were able to enslave people. That sort of context is lost.
Right.
And so people are able to say, but we photographed them. They were members of the family.
One of my favorite aspects of your book is that you do not filter out the enslaved by any means, but foreground even stories of enslaved people throughout all of your chapters. You know, even though you are weaving together analyses of British imperial influence, of elite Qajar familial and architectural structures, you always center the stories of enslaved people. I'd like to talk about one of these figures who I think the story of gives a very good example of what we've just been talking about as well, the man that you begin with, a man named Yakut, or rather, as you open your introduction, there were many Yakuts, as you discuss naming conventions surrounding enslaved men and women. But in chapter two, you discuss a specific Yakut, and even though he was actually not technically enslaved, he was forced to sign away the rights to any children he might have in order to be able to marry the enslaved woman he wanted to marry. Can you tell our listeners more about this story?
Yeah, absolutely. The story of Yahut, or the way he's referred to in the document, Yahut Kolam, it's just a source that's 8 lines long. It's mm-hmm. very short. And yet there's so much in those 8 lines to unpack. Yeah. I do have a small correction. You say that it's he gives up the rights of his children to marry the woman he wanted to marry. Uh-huh. But we don't know that. We don't know if he wanted to marry her. Right. He just does. We don't know the levels of coercion that are that are present, although we can sort of imagine. But
and I love how you raise all of those questions throughout each chapter as well. Mm. You know, you sort of present something like this story, and then you do sort of get at all of the possibilities that they might bring about, which I really love.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think something that's uncomfortable with this story, with not just the story, but this history, is sort of the unknowability of it all.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was really important for me to sit with that throughout the book.
Of course.
But the story of Yahut Kolam is that this contract that I found is, like I said, 8 lines long. There are several mm-hmm. stamps, official stamps around it, of people approving of the contract. And he gives the rights of his unborn children to a certain person whose last name is either Selmi or Salma or Solami. You know, the vowelization I don't exactly know, but someone who is described as being a very dignified person.
Right.
Yahut Kolam is described as being black, black in the face, black colored. The contract is, maybe I should double check, but I believe it's from 1837.
Yes,
thank you.
Of course.
It's over a decade before the first treaty towards the abolition of the slave trade. And it's also remarkable for how it goes literally against the grain of Islamic social norms of enslavement,
right?
Where the status of a person is supposed to follow their father. Your father's free, you are free. Your father's enslaved, you're enslaved. And so this contract, because they emphasize his blackness, tells me that even in 1837, blackness had become really heavily associated with enslavement.
Right.
He is, I believe, formally enslaved, right? So he does have a former enslaved status.
Right.
And his wife is still enslaved. But that really should not have dictated the status of his children. His children should have been free.
Right.
I think this story is important to me for so many reasons. First, it's so gut-wrenching.
Oh, completely.
The woman in the story is not even... I keep saying story. The woman in the contract is not mm-hmm. even named.
Yeah.
She's just described as being very beautiful, very sweet, very comely, if you will.
Right.
We have no other traces, that at least none that I found. I have no idea if he ever did bear children, mm-hmm. If they ever were forced to give them to this person. Presumably they did. Right. We don't know if they were separated, where they were, if they were in contact, how... None of that. We have no idea. The other reason why the story is important to me is I get a lot of people telling me, well, the stuff you're writing can't be possible because racism is un-Islamic and people were Muslims at this time. And sure, it goes against the Sharia, like, fine. Yeah. But people did not care. People were really making up social rules for themselves. There are like 7 people stamping this contract, giving... you know, Salmi the like green light to take this person's children. And also there were others involved in the slave trade. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't so bound by Islamic law in the way that people want it to be.
Right.
And so that was also important for me to point out.
So a couple of final questions for you. I think something a lot of scholars struggle with is whether or not our work will actually have impact or reach audiences outside of academia. And as we've already discussed, and you mention in your chapter on blackface practices in Iranian folk theater that in March of 2021, I quote, the Tehran municipality announced that it was temporarily suspending blackface in its Nowruz performances because they had learned of scholarship that had connected blackface to a history of enslavement. And this was your scholarship that the Collective for Black Iranians had shared on social media. So first, I mean, to me, this is very indicative of your work having actual impact, even though I know you follow up the comment with a note that nothing has been done about it since. But I still think that's a pretty incredible thing to have happened. I'd love to hear more about this, but would also love for you to share a bit of this history with our listeners. How are these ongoing practices of blackface connected to the history of enslavement in Iran?
So in March of 2021, I was part of this special issue coming out of Lateral, which is the open access journal of the Cultural Studies Association. And in it, I wrote a very brief piece tracing this history of blackface in Iran. Mm-hmm. And I particularly look at Haji Firuz, but I do look a little bit broader than just the Nowruz minstrel. For Ajam's listeners, many of them will already sort of know this history, but Haji Firuz is directly linked to the history of enslavement in Iran. And this is based on research that I did on the eunuchs, on how there were circus troops in the Qajar court during the late 19th century who were given permission to basically make fun of anyone they wanted to. And amongst the people that they made fun of, and they made fun of a lot of people, by all means, but amongst the people that they made fun of were the eunuchs.
Right.
And this is sort of an accepted history, even amongst practitioners of blackface in Iran, that it was a practice that was making a mockery of the eunuchs because it was funny.
Right.
And there, you know, I quote Saadi Afshar in my book. Saadi Afshar is recognized as one of the sort of major blackface actors in Iran. And in his memoir, he says he learned it from, you know, the greats and the greats before him. Would go into the Qajar court, see what sort of funny things the eunuchs were saying, what their mannerisms were like, and they would come and sort of busk in the streets. And that's how the genre developed. So I traced this history, a very brief history, and it's an open access article. And it was important for me that it be an open access article because Haji Firuz is really the bane of my existence. For someone who grew up in the Iranian community, he was impossible to escape. Like,
right.
We all grew up with him. If you are an Iranian in Iran or if you are an Iranian in diaspora, up until, you know, recent years, there's no way someone went to a Nowruz event and like a large Nowruz event and there was not some sort of reference to Haji Firuz. So Haji Firuz is someone who appears wearing sort of red outfit with a tambourine. He sings these songs about my master, hold your head up high, my master be so happy, it's Nowruz, it's the new year. And he appears in blackface and he says the words backwards. So instead of Salam alaikum, he'll say Somboli alaikum, which then is like a phallic reference because of the shape of a hyacinth, the sombol. And so there's just a lot of double entendres, but it is just a very vulgar act.
Yeah.
And I would really like to see Nowruz for the next generation not have Haji Firuz involved.
Right.
And so I wrote this open access piece and I had no idea when it was going to get published, but it was published like the week before Nowruz.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even on Twitter anymore, but I shared the article and I don't know, it was retweeted hundreds of times.
Yeah.
It really went, it was sort of, it just like went out of my hands. And
right.
I was by no means a large account on Twitter. That mm-hmm. was not, I didn't have like a major presence or anything like that. it just started a major conversation. And it was such a large conversation that it was out of hand. It was a lot. You remember it. I mean, it got tweeted so much that the Tehran municipality picked up on it. And the Collective for Black Iranians, of course, they made images around it that also amplified it.
Yeah.
And they were a larger account. And then there were several other accounts that also made their own images around it independently of me. And so when the deputy mayor tweeted about it, he got a lot of backlash about the suspension. They got backlash because it is still somehow very controversial.
Right.
And then he followed up with this article that I had written that had been spinning in the, you know, Iranian Twitter sphere or whatever. I included in the book just to show how this history is still so controversial.
Very much so.
And still the work is ongoing.
Absolutely. Thinking of work being ongoing, you end your book very poetically and poignantly, I would say, with an epilogue, but not an ending. I quote, "I spent over half this book describing what forgetting looks like, but what can remembering look like?" If I may say so myself, I think you've done a remarkable job initiating the remembering process here and raising so many important questions about it. So I wanted to ask, do you have a vision of what this remembering can look like?
Thank you so much. It's so important for us to look forward, I think, when we're studying history.
Absolutely.
I agree. So often we get caught looking in the rear view mirror, but right. Really we're trying to figure out where we're going.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you said earlier that I really did try to center these voices, the voices of the enslaved, to honor their stories. But I really think as we move forward, more stories from Black Iranian families, from families of the formerly enslaved, I think those will become really critical to telling this story.
Yeah.
And I really look forward to the work of the next generation in this regard.
I do as well.
I hope I did the sources that I had justice, but I know...
I think you did.
Thank you.
But I know, very much so.
I know there has to be more, right? There has to be more. And I hope that I hope that I made room for those stories to come in.
Citing your work very frequently in everything I've written recently, I can say that I think you've made wonderful space. I'm so glad that you have.
So generous of you to say.
Finally, if there is one main thing that you would like our listeners and hopefully your future readers to take away from the book, what would that be?
You know, Ajam has such a special audience and following, where it's scholars, but then it's also not. It's Iranians, but it's also much broader than that.
Yeah.
It's a very diverse group. And I think beyond sort of the nuts and bolts of my book, that yes, there was a history of slavery in Iran and in the broader mm-hmm. Middle East. And yes, there was a bit of a cover-up, right? And an intentional erasure in Iran, but also in other parts of the Middle East, and the Persian world. I think if I had to say like one takeaway would be to really investigate the past without being defensive about it.
Oh, I love that. That is perfect. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for joining us. This has truly been an honor to discuss your work. I'm very excited to talk about it more with my students in the fall. It's already on the syllabus for both classes I'm teaching, and I can't wait to hear what they think. And there's so much today that we didn't get a chance to discuss that this book touches on. So I encourage all our listeners to find The Color Black, Enslavement and Erasure in Iran, wherever you like to get your books. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you to Ajam.